On the Wintrust Business Lunch, Elise Glink joins us on Mondays, most Mondays at this time. She's the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. I heard you and Tom Fortino Sunday morning between 7 and 8. It was a good show this Sunday.
Thank you. We had a lot of conversation about Silicon Valley Bank and what's going on. And of course, it's all still making news today. And in fact, there are some economists out there that are just, I don't know, the talk is getting downright scary, John.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, Larry Kotlikoff, who is an economist I really admire, is concerned that, you know, if we see First Republic Bank fall, which is certainly things are very interesting there, that would be, you know, yet another really big bank that isn't able to cope with rising interest rates and had used, or perhaps misused might be a better term, misused those bonds or treasuries to balance out their books. And by misuse, I mean they weren't really thinking about what would happen when interest rates jumped up so much.
You just wonder who's minding the cookie store or whatever. I mean, you on the one hand, you would think federal regulators. On the other hand, you would think bank presidents who would not put their assets so at risk that they might end up losing the bank. It's amazing to me the almost incompetence or indifference here.
Well, it's very interesting. So the New York Times had a story this morning that actually said the Federal Reserve had Silicon Valley Bank under review for at least a year because of their capital practices. They had warned the bank they were using faulty logic with regard to its holdings. I mean, you know, the bond stuff we just talked about. 2 years ago in 2021, apparently the Fed gave Silicon Valley Bank 6 citations. These are warnings like, hey, guys, red flag here, matters requiring attention, matters requiring immediate attention. And that really gave Silicon Valley Bank notice that they were doing kind of a bad job of managing capital ratios and money on hand. And that's when interest rates were low, John. But by last year, 2022, according to the New York Times, Silicon Valley Bank was in full supervisory review. They were rated deficient for governance and controls.
When was this?
2022, last July.
So these depositors then that, you know, woke up Saturday morning and said, wait a minute, what's happening or what has happened? I wonder how aware of all of this were they?
Well, they wouldn't be aware of it at all, right? Because according to the New York Times, while all of this stuff should be public, some things are more public than others. And by early this year, Silicon Valley Bank was given what the Fed calls a horizontal review, meaning that they were not doing very well for risk management, and they identified even additional deficiencies. But here's the thing that really bothers me, John. The CEO of Silicon Valley Bank was sitting, I guess he's been removed now, but he was sitting on the board of the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank. So even though he didn't have anything to do with who was, you know, who the regulators were for his bank per se, it was not like he was maybe checking on them. The optics are that he was in close communication, or he could have been in close communication with them. And what does that actually mean?
What's the next domino here?
Well, it's sort of interesting. Larry Kotlikoff, the economist we were just speaking about, he thinks it's going to be First Republic. And the reason he thinks that, and this was sort of interesting, I didn't pick this up, but when all of the banks came together, the big banks last week, and they said, we're going to put $30 billion into First Republic and shore it up and whatever, they made deposits. What they didn't do, according to Kotlikoff, is they didn't actually buy the stock of the company. Why did they do that? Well, it's interesting. The feds are clearly insuring the deposits of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. So all those people who had tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in those banks, they're made whole, right? But the investors who bought the stock, they got wiped out. So these banks probably thought to themselves, Well, let's not lose our $30 billion. That's real money. So let's put it into a deposit, because if the bank fails, we'll get our money back, maybe with a little bit of a haircut, but we won't lose everything. But that doesn't really, that didn't really help, you know, First Reserve. And it's entirely possible that there are a bunch of other regional banks that are also in the same, you know, sort of problem that First Republic is, where I said First Reserve, I meant to say First Republic, where there are $8 trillion of deposits, $8 trillion with a T, that are actually not under the $250,000 limit that's insurable. And so is the Fed going to actually bail out all of those depositors if some of those banks also fail? And so this is where Kotlikoff was saying that you could be at this tipping point where our banking system is going to fall right into another dark hole where it was in 2008. And up until the time this morning when I started reading some of his work about this, I would have said, I don't think so. It feels like it's stabilizing, but I don't know anymore. There are some real concerns with the way that interest rates have jumped up so quickly, and the banks that have these treasuries that are not that are holding them to maturity, but not doing what the Fed wants them to do, which is called mark to market, where you actually value them at any point in time where they are. If you had to sell them today, they'd mm-hmm. all have to mm-hmm. sell at a deep discount. So it's concerning.
You wonder then if the Fed is going to do, well, 25 points. Is there talk about them doing zero? What's going to happen?
Well, this is the big question, and this is the big week. So the Fed is meeting this week, and this is where they're supposed to also give guidance on what's going to happen for the rest of the year. It's kind of all Fed meetings are big meetings, but this is a particularly interesting one, especially coming now. So originally, this was like about a month ago, the Fed kind of indicated it was going to jump it up pretty significantly. They thought, and people thought, a half a point. And then all this stuff started unraveling with the banks. So they're like, well, the Fed's not going to do anything. They're going to hold steady. And then Jerome Powell said, you know, full speed ahead. And Janet Yellen and he came out with a joint statement yesterday, which I read this and I thought, oh, gosh, we might be in trouble, where he and Janet Yellen reassured the world, just mm-hmm. a little statement that everything is A-OK. And you know what? If they felt like they needed to do that, doesn't that make you worry, John?
Well, one of the comics, I forget who it was, but they had a series of clips of Joe Biden saying something like, you know, the system is stable, the system is stable, the system is stable. Don't worry, everything is okay. Don't worry, everything is okay, which makes you think maybe everything isn't okay if he's repeating that over and over again.
Sure.
But let me read you what Terry Savage posted. She wrote, last Monday, as the failure of Silicon Valley Bank was becoming apparent, I posted the following analysis on my website, and then it's down below. She writes now, I would not change a word. Yet even as the fears of fragility in the global banking system have accelerated, it is clear that governments will do as they must to restore confidence, no matter what it takes. And it's a good bet they will succeed despite the gloomy prognostications. What do you make of that?
She's absolutely right. I mean, the reason we have government, you know, people talk about, oh, let's have a smaller, more limited government. Well, in times of crisis, you want to have a big government with a big printing press in its basement so that it can do the things it needs to do to keep our financial system running smoothly. For everybody out there who doesn't like having a big government, today's the day you're happy you have one.
No kidding. Will you talk about Credit Suisse for just a moment?
Sure. So that was the next bank to fail. It was bought over the weekend in a deal brokered by the Swiss government for $3.2 billion. Their first offer for the assets of it was for $1 billion, and I think everybody went, yeah, no, I don't think so. The Swiss National Bank lent 100 billion Swiss francs to make it happen, and they basically, it's one of the articles I read today said, they kind of bribed USB to take it on. But there was, you know, this was one of those things where you just have to do it. And so They are UBS will digest its chief competitor. It's going to wipe out $17 billion worth of Credit Suisse bonds. It's eliminating the need for UBS shareholders to vote on the deal. So, you know, this is going down quickly. And so they're going to preserve as much of it as they can. But that's just yet another example of what's going on. And now we have to watch companies, organizations like PacWest Bank, Western Alliance Bank. Both of those are kind of, you know, concerned. There's concern.
You know, as we wrap this up, I did not know that many people had that much money in banks. Most of us have, I thought, less than $250,000 in a given account in a given bank. You just said how many trillions of dollars are exceed 250,000?
$8 trillion of $18 trillion are unsecured, meaning that they are over the 250,000.
Right. Is there any talk about raising then the guarantee of insurance for deposits up to 250?
Well, you know, it's funny. Elizabeth Warren, of all people, is out there saying raise it to any limit possible, which honestly, most of it is businesses, small businesses that have that, or even some large businesses. Of course, some large investors who are Silicon Valley investors would get, you know, included in that as well. But she's out there talking about it. Several other people are now starting to say, just insure everything. But I got to tell you, there's a moral hazard involved when you insure everybody for everything in their lives. And we're going to face that question too, John.
This Week in Wealth, WGN Radio, Sunday mornings with Tom Fortino. Think Glink, the website for Elise Glink. Thanks, Elise. Nice to talk to you today.
You too, John.
Jim Dahlke joins us, the national editor at Chicago Inno. I have to start with a postscript, Jim. You have talked to us many times about Cameo, the website based in Chicago. And you may have seen Rick Hogan's piece in the Tribune Sunday about Governor Blagojevich singing. And in the piece, they mentioned how many Cameo videos he's done, or at least the fact that he's got 1,000 five-star ratings. If that means 1,000 personal messages to people, he said he gets $100 for every 30-second message. So by my math, that's $100,000 minimum that Blago has made on Cameo. Does that surprise you at all?
You know, it doesn't surprise me, and Rod Blagojevich kind of fits a very specific type of niche, I think, that works well on Cameo. It's like, you know, these sort of micro celebrities within their own sort of spheres, and so, you know, you see a lot of that on the internet, like internet celebrities, people who are really famous in areas like YouTube videos or TikTok or what have you. Politics is certainly a part of that, right? There are certainly political circles where, you know, a message from Blagojevich can generate some chuckles or cringes or whatever you're interested in with a video like that, right? So, no, it doesn't surprise me. Cameo gets about a 25% cut of that. So, you know, I think a lot of people saw Cameo when it came out. It's like, how are these guys ever going to make it? They're never going to get the big celebrities to use that thing. They don't need the big celebrities to use that thing because a lot of people are still interested in that sort of B, C, and D list celebrity, and especially with a price point that's not outrageous. It turns out to be a funny gift for folks.
Evidently, 630, one of our listeners, after I mentioned this previously, mentioned, hey, John, I actually purchased a Cameo from Rod Blagojevich for a friend's birthday. The video had Rod's signature grandstanding peppered throughout, but the video was still heartwarming, genuine, and caring. I'd buy one again in a heartbeat. How about that?
And that's really what has to work for Cameo, is that the people on it, the talent on it, the celebrities on it have to buy into it. They can't just sort of like willy-nilly put out a little video. They really have to put in a lot of effort to it. And those are the folks that do really, really well. A lot of the cast of The Office, some of the lesser known characters, definitely not the Michael Scotts, but some of the, you know, the Kevin Malones and folks have done really, really well. And it's because they're funny and they're genuine and they really kind of buy into it. And so, you know, obviously the folks that put in the effort are the ones that see the reward.
Cameo isn't exactly a startup anymore, but it's the sort of business that would have money in a bank like SVB. Is there a connection there in any way, do you know?
Yeah, you know, we've been following this story, obviously, you know, at American Inno and Chicago Inno, you know, over the last week and a half now. I mean, this is a story that has just extended far beyond Silicon Valley. Lots of Chicago startups had money in Silicon Valley, did their banking with Silicon Valley, did loans through Silicon Valley Bank. You know, I think it's a bit of a misnomer, right, that Silicon Valley Bank is a Silicon Valley problem. And, you know, we talked to Scott Catoon, the founder of Songfinch, a startup here that's not totally unlike Cameo. It helps you connect with artists to create personalized songs. So really interesting startup. He had quite a bit of money in Silicon Valley Bank himself, was able to get almost 95% of it out before transfers were completely halted the other Friday. So, you know, but he told us, you know, look, you know, it's a big gap left by Silicon Valley Bank. You know, the loans, the rates they're able to get for startups, you know, every other bank would say no way, right? So this is a lender that was startup friendly, and certainly startup friendly to Chicago. And it was a bank that actually also connected Chicago to the coast. It was able to kind of help connect the dots, you know, for Midwest startups to the Valley.
He had $11 million, Alex Zorn wrote at Biz, at your site. He had $11 million, Scott Catoon did, who hosted a radio show here on weekends for a couple of years at WGN. He had $11 million in. That weekend, he was able to get his money out just before they halted business. But since the federal regulators said that they would insure all deposits, he would have been made whole either way, or did he just miss an $11 million haircut? I wonder how that would have played out.
Yeah, so he would have been made whole either way, but he didn't know that at the time. And I think that that's what kind of was all the panic, right? And that's what caused the run, you know, on that Thursday and Friday, where, you know, there was a panic sort of across the startup sector. And that is sort of the sad irony of the Silicon Valley Bank situation, that it was a bank, you know, by startups for startups, and then, you know, it was startups that ended up killing it. You know, so they were the ones that ended up pulling money out en masse and creating the problem for them, you know, in the long run. And so, at the end of the day, you know, those founders, whether they pulled money out or not, would have been made whole. But it was certainly, you know, at the time, a very frantic and chaotic situation where, hey, you did not know what was going to happen, you know, with those deposits.
Because they were only going to get 80 or 60 or 90 cents on the dollar for those 10-year notes, the bank was not in a very good position to assure assets. And that's when these investors, these depositors found out, and they started pulling money out. It makes one wonder then, the bank mismanaged or miscalculated. But really, if everybody hadn't decided to pull their money out, we wouldn't be here today. I could see how both of those were maybe not equally responsible, but there was a sort of dual responsibility for the failure of the bank, right?
Right. It's a little bit of the prisoner's dilemma, right? You know, if everybody just sort of stays calm and doesn't overreact, everything sort of probably ends up okay. But, you know, everybody sort of freaked out. And that's, you know, the situation that Silicon Valley Bank was in, too. You know, a lot of these venture capital firms have their money there, and they have all the, you know, very similar portfolios shared by other venture capitalists. So it was actually very, you know, the communication between all these startups was actually rather seamless. You know, it kind of happens in an email or a Slack chat or a group message, and sort of you're able within a handful of VC firms to, you know, connect with hundreds of startups who are able to pull money out in a matter of minutes.
In a matter of minutes, so the bank's not able to cover it because they can't get the money, and now they have to start selling at a discount. But if everybody hadn't gotten spooked, the bank would not have had to do that. I mean, we did not have to be here. They were the first domino, if you will. And again, I'm not saying the bank didn't mismanage the assets, but we would not be here if everybody didn't decide to pull their money out at once.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think we'll have to see the postmortem on this, right, like over time. But I think that's exactly correct. I think if everybody had just sort of remained calm, you know, that the bank would have raised additional funds as it was planning to do, that announcement that they sent out that Wednesday of that week. And if everybody had sort of remained steady, I think I don't think that we would have been in this situation at all. Right. But I mean, there was, you know, panic from many startups across the country, and their investors, you know, we're telling them, you know, it's sort of this double-edged sword where lots of investors are saying, hey, okay, you know what, don't panic, remain calm, but you know, I might pull a little bit of money out just to be sure. And so, like, I think that created a lot of confusion for folks. And at the end of the day, a lot of people were saying, hey, you know, I want to be safe here, and I want to be, you know, a good steward of this investor money that has been, you know, invested in my business, and I want to make sure that I can make payroll next week, and I can, you know, cover the assets for my employees next week. So there was a lot of chaos here. Luckily, you know, crisis averted at the end of the day, but I mean, we're going to have to see over time how this incident is going to play out on the health of the startup ecosystem moving forward.
Yeah, I'm thinking about your piece about venture capitalist Chris Olson, who said, "I'm permanently scarred from this." That's where will I find that? American Inno or ChicagoInno.com? That's where I can read that, right, Jim?
Yeah, ChicagoInno.com's got a link to that story as well. And really, I mean, that piece is really kind of looking at venture firms also that had money. And so it wasn't just startups. It was also the venture capitalists themselves. And so Drive Capital out of Columbus, you know, had about a third of its portfolio of more than 100 companies banking with Silicon Valley. It itself banked with Silicon Valley Bank. Generator, Startup Accelerator out of Wisconsin, also was scrambling as it was banking with Silicon Valley Bank. So, you know, it's tricky. A lot of startups were turning to their investors and say, "Hey, like, could you help us cover payroll next week if we're unable to access our funds?" And some of these VC firms were saying, "Hey, our funds are tied up in Silicon Valley Bank too." Yeah. So it was startups and investors that were scrambling.
You can read it all. That's Jim Dahlke, national editor at American Inno and ChicagoInno.com. Thank you for your insight today, Jim. Really interesting.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago startup on a mission to provide world-class music education that's accessible to more people has secured new funding through a Series A round. Trala raised $8 million, which pushes its total to $15 million. It's an online music school launched in 2017. They use technology that listens to a person play their instrument, and it gives instant feedback on their practice. The app also pairs students with teachers. Their target audience is musicians who wouldn't have access to music education otherwise. In 2022, Trala saw 14 times growth and added 30 new music teachers to its roster. This new funding will help the company expand further. Illinois lawmakers are considering legislation that would change the classification of rideshare companies like Uber and Lyft to common carriers. It would open them up to the same level of liability as other forms of public transportation. The bill passed the House last week and now moves on to the Senate. The bill was spurred by concerns for rider safety. Being exempted from the common carrier doctrine insulates rideshare company liability from acts of their drivers when injuries to customers happen. The common carrier doctrine in Illinois currently includes taxicabs, railways, and even elevators. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We call this the Business of Food with Steve Alexander.
Yes, and thank you to the Chevy Silverado HD for sponsoring us today. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. I can't think of many things farther, well, figuratively at least, from the corn stalks of Illinois than Paris Fashion Week. But there it was, King Corn playing a big role in Stella McCartney's Winter 2023 runway show. And in Paris with Stella was this guy.
Luke Haberhals. I'm the founder and CEO of Natural Fiber Welding.
There are no welding torches at Natural Fiber Welding, but it does take the unused fiber from corn, soybeans, and countless other plants and turns them into, or welds them, into planet-friendly materials that can replace materials made with planet-unfriendly plastic.
What I realized is if humans were going to make any progress on these problems of plastics, it would require a holistic, very disruptive solution.
Stella showed designer bags in Paris that were made with NFW's patented leather-like Mirum. No animals, no plastic, all natural, and she declared, "The future of fashion has arrived." And it started in Peoria, where former chemistry professor Haberhals created a company out of what he discovered in a lab, that natural fibers from plants can fulfill the Earth's natural circularity.
They don't have to go to a landfill. They can actually get ground up and given right back to nature.
And if designer bags aren't your thing, there are shoes already on the market, including Allbirds and Camper, using a variety of NFW's materials. And one company, Unless, has a model called Degenerate, a nice wordplay on the name, made completely from all-natural NFW products. And you know the old saying about build a better mousetrap? Well, Luke Haberhals says the world is watching.
You know, there's a huge network effect of how quickly humans can stop making so much stuff out of plastic and instead make it the natural fiber welding way.
And the beauty of it, unlike petroleum-based materials, there is an endless supply of raw materials for NFW to use.
You know, I did not have to invent plants
Cool stuff. Investors are jumping on board.
Because there's a revolutionary thing happening in Peoria, Illinois, and it's ready to go around the world. And it's your favorite shoe brand. It's your favorite furniture brand. It's your favorite clothing brand. It's your favorite car brands.
300 people in Peoria, changing the world. More info at naturalfiberwelding.com. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Here's Megan Hart. She's the executive director of the Local Initiatives Support Corporation, LISC, in Chicago. Megan, welcome to WGN. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on, John. Appreciate it.
You're about securing the resources for businesses to develop on the South Side. Is that right?
We work across all low to moderate income communities. So South and West Side, primarily heavily black and brown communities in the city, those that are underinvested and underrepresented in lots of decisions across the city.
And is it securing the loans? Is it helping them with all sorts of business development issues? What do you all do then?
Sure. We do what we call comprehensive community development. And what that really means is identifying and working in support of communities, partners, and small businesses across the city to try and revitalize neighborhoods. And the way we do that is through investments. And that's, to your point, loans, grants, technical assistance, community planning to really get to source what the community is interested in as far as investment and then try and drive investment into those areas.
Tell me about a business that you've worked with.
I have a couple that I would love to talk about. One is called Straight Law, and they're in Humboldt Park, and that's a individual, a reentering citizen that turned his life into a location. It's on Division. It's Straight Law Cooking, and they have amazing food, but they also do catering. That's one example. We have a good friend, Evelyn, on the South Side, and she's Evelyn's Food Love in Washington Park, and she has a restaurant on the South Side. A lot in restaurants, personal care, professional services, those amenities that we take for granted in some communities, mm-hmm. and others we need to really support and build up.
Is the hard part securing loans for them?
The hard part is definitely securing loans. So when you think about how small businesses start, you have to have some collateral to get a loan. So if you think about the racial wealth gap and the lack of owning property or personal wealth, that's usually how people start their business, either through friends and family giving, or they have their own personal wealth. And when we address issues of inequities, those resources aren't available to small businesses or entrepreneurs, largely black and brown. And so it's really hard to get capital. And so you really start very small, you start renting. And our goal is really, how do we help that business build wealth? How do we get them to purchase the location instead of renting? Mm-hmm. And then how do we help them expand the business?
I didn't know you were out there. I'm glad there is something like this. I think a lot of us look at all of the issues that plague the city or all the opportunities that are in front of the city, and we say there needs to be economic independence. There needs to be wherewithal. How's that going to happen? That's what you're trying to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's plenty of partners. LISC isn't just alone out there. There's a number of partners that are in the same space as we are and organizations on the ground and communities that are really lifting up residents and small businesses that make it all work.
Megan Hart is the executive director of that group, LISC, Local Initiatives Support Corporation in Chicago, LISC.org/Chicago. Good to know, Megan. Let's talk again. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a great day.